Have you ever wondered how changes in the economy affect your wallet? This episode's recording is from a panel discussion with financial planners Eric Cooper and Brian Luce from Triangle Financial Group. They discuss some important foundational questions about the economy, money, and how it all relates to you. Stay tuned. You're listening to Triangle's Making Money Personal podcast, where we engage in real talk about financial matters that affect our community. Today's episode is sponsored by Triangle Credit Union, recently voted best credit union in New Hampshire.
Hi guys, thanks for joining Triangle Credit Union and Triangle Financial Group. Today we're gonna discuss how changes in the economy affect your wallet. My name is Becky Thomas. I'm Senior Vice President of Marketing at Triangle Credit Union. I'm going to be hosting today's event with our special guest experts. This is Brian Luce. You want to say hi, Brian?
Hi, everyone.
And Eric Cooper.
Give a wave. Hey, everybody.
They are both financial planners from Triangle Financial Group and are experts today. Brian has been in financial planning for over 18 years. His goal, as he likes to say, is to teach people the art of managing their money in a fun and simple way. I think you really do that, by the way, Brian, thankfully. Personal finance is so tough. Eric, you've been a financial planner for over a decade. And Eric believes that a custom approach rooted in education, which is really the key to it all, allows you to understand the financial principles so that you can take empowered actions that fit you. So we appreciate you both being here. I'd also like to thank UNH's TRIO program students for submitting over 25 multi-part questions. That was amazing. Thank you so much. We can absolutely not answer them all today, unfortunately, but we have selected three questions for the event. And those students whose questions were selected are going to receive a $50 Amazon gift code as a gift from Triangle Credit Union. So I think without further ado, we're ready to start our program. You guys ready?
Yes.
Ready as ever.
Awesome. So our first question comes from Isabella Thompson. Congratulations, Isabella. So this question is, what's the best way to stay financially protected when the economy isn't doing well? She says she doesn't really understand how credit works. So if you wouldn't mind explaining that, it would be really appreciated. So Eric, why don't you start us off?
Sure. Well, Isabella, that's a great question because credit can be pretty complicated. So let me break it down into the different components that go into determining a credit score and how your actions may impact that. You'll see me referencing my notes because there's a lot of things that go into a credit score here. So most people think that they build their credit by building a good payment history, and that's a big piece of it. But there are other pieces that are almost equally as important to a credit score. Before I teach you the factors in the score, let me give you this point of definition. Revolving loans is credit that is renewed as you pay it down. So think about a credit card. You have a $2,000 limit. You have a $1,000 balance. You make a $500 payment. Now that money is available for you to go spend again. It's revolving credit. An installment loan or installment credit is a loan that's given to you, like a car loan, for example, that you pay down. And as you pay it down, you just pay off the debt until it's gone, and then you stop paying. I'm going to use these terms as I explain how credit works and how the different pieces of the score interact. So your utilization rate of your revolving credit is the second most important piece of your credit score, meaning the amount of revolving loan that you have available to you, for example, credit cards, the amount of it that you're using and how often you're using it, is the second most important piece of determining what your credit score is, second only to your payment history. So number one is making your payments on time and making sure that you honor the loans that you sign. Secondarily is your utilization of your revolving credit. So for example, if you have three credit cards with a $1,000 balance and you have a $700 balance on two of them and a $0 balance on one, you have $3,000 in available credit and a $1,400 balance. So your utilization rate is that 1,400 divided by the 3,000, which is 47%. Generally speaking, for an ideal credit score, you want to be at 30% or less. So this is why a lot of times you'll hear people say, when you pay off a credit card, don't close the card, leave the card open. The reason is because it counts as available credit. So even if you're not using it, it can help your score because it makes your utilization rate lower on the credit cards that you are using. So outside of your utilization rate and the payment history, 15% is going to be your length of credit history. The longer that you've been paying loans successfully and the longer that you've been responsible, the more that will weigh into your credit score. 10% is how diverse your credit is. So for example, we've talked about revolving loans. We've talked about installment loans. But even within those, car loans versus mortgages versus student loans versus credit cards versus home equity lines of credit, the diversity of credit that you have can increase your score, because that tells the credit bureaus that you do well with multiple types of loans, not just one. And then 10% of your score is new credit. I want to spend a little bit of time on this. And Brian, you might have some thoughts on this as well, because we get this question pretty often in the bank. You've probably heard in terms of credit, the words hard pull and soft pull on your credit, or a hard inquiry and a soft inquiry. Here's the difference. Both times a financial institution or an institution is going in and checking your credit score. But the credit bureaus will penalize your credit score if you inquire to obtain new credit often. So if I apply for a car loan and Triangle Credit Union pulls my credit, that is a hard inquiry because I'm asking them to pull my credit because I'm seeking new debt. There's other scenarios where your credit will be pulled. For example, sometimes when you get an auto insurance policy, the insurance company will pull your credit to see how good you are at paying your bills. That counts as a soft inquiry. It does not count against your credit because that the purpose of checking your credit in that scenario is not for you to obtain new debt. It's just the financial institution, they want to know that you can pay your bills. So anytime that you're going to have your credit pulled or something tells you, people have to tell you if they're going to pull your credit for something. Anytime they tell you, pay attention to whether it's a hard inquiry or a soft inquiry. A hard inquiry every once in a while isn't really going to make a difference. But if you're constantly applying for new loans, that can definitely drive down your score. So those are the five main things that will factor into your credit score, which is called a FICO score. I'm sure you've heard that word before. And there's three main bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. They all have their own ways of scoring, but all three of them will provide a credit score. And usually the FICO score is a combination of those three at some level.
Great job. And also, you can get your credit score if you have a credit card like Capital One. I have a Capital One credit card where I can go on to CreditWise, which is their program, and you can check your credit score. Now, that credit score is a little bit different than your TransUnion, Equifax, some of the major credit reporting companies. That score is a little bit different than what you would get if you actually go for a car. But nowadays, you can check your credit score pretty much every day. A lot of those, like, for example, Capital One, the apps have a great education, program where you can learn ways to improve your credit if you have bad credit, ways to build credit. So they are very insightful as far as the information that they provide on those apps. So again, it's not your actual credit score, but it's pretty close and it is based on your credit history. So yeah, Eric, great job. Good insight as far as how your credit is built. Now, the second part or first part to the question really is how to stay financially protected when the economy isn't doing well. So the best way to stay financially protected if you have credit during times when the economy is not doing well is not to be too dependent on that credit. The way to do that is you want to have a healthy emergency fund. What is healthy? Well, a lot of experts recommend that you should have at least 3 to 6 months of expenses in savings. 3 to 6 months is a pretty wide range, right? 3 months versus six. So there's a lot of factors that go into how much you should have in savings. On the low side of that range is somebody who is in relatively good health. They have job security, meaning they work for maybe the government or somewhere where not a lot of layoffs. They have low debt, reliable transportation. A lot of times your car could, you could have a malfunction with your car that's expensive, not covered by insurance. So having reliable transportation, and you live in a low cost area, somewhere where it's not expensive to live. So if those factors go into your reserves, then you don't need 6 months. You're more on the low side of that 3 month savings goal. On the other end of the spectrum, this is the opposite. You might live in a large city like Boston or New York, where the cost of living is very high. A lot of people who live in the big cities, they don't have cars, but maybe they have a lot of student loan debt. They might work in a career that has a lot of turnover, or when the economy gets, when we hit difficult times in the economy, you see a lot of layoffs, and maybe it's not easy for you to find another job. So that is what somebody who should be more in the 6 month range as far as an emergency fund. There are other factors that go into how much you should have, such as high risk activities. I'm an avid skier. I grew up going to, you know, Loon and Waterville and skiing on the chairlifts. And at some point that just doesn't excite me anymore. So now I do backcountry skiing. So I'm hiking up mountains in the backcountry and skiing. That's a high risk activity. If you don't have great insurance, you have a high deductible and you get hurt, well, you're going to have to come up with a lot more to cover that deductible. If you have a medical condition, you know, not everybody's perfect health-wise. So if you had a medical condition, then you want to make sure you have more in your reserve. And then family support is big. You know, what if you did fall on hard times? Are you, you know, would your families be able to help or support you? And then what support would they give you? So those are factors that go into, you know, what type of reserve you should have when the economy kind of hits the skids and we fall on hard times. So how do you set a what do you do to set a savings or set up an emergency fund? The first thing is you want to set a goal. Figure out what one month's worth of expenses are and focus only on the expenses you would still need to pay if you had, you know, an emergency. You could definitely forgo your Netflix subscription if you had to, I'm sure. So the expenses on the list should be necessary, not discretionary. Once you figure that amount out, the best way is to multiply by the number of months you need as far as reserve. And then you should automate the process. With today's technology, you know, you can set up automatic deposits out of your paychecks or out of your savings accounts into a separate savings account titled emergency fund, or title it whatever you want to call it. Set and forget it is a good strategy. You don't have to think about it. It just, you know, does it on its own. So those are ways that you start an emergency fund. And savings is like any other habit, like working out is a habit. Savings is a habit. You need to develop a good habit. It's almost better to get in the habit, but don't try to focus on the big number. Like I need $5,000 worth of reserve. Get in the habit of saving, and then eventually you'll get there. So that is how you stay financially protected when the economy isn't doing well.
That's awesome. Thank you, guys. The second question is from Emily Johnson. Her question is, are emergency funds important, and in what way? So if people are experiencing extra cash flow currently, or the cash flow is a lot lower than it should be, how should those in college handle this money that they have or do not have? So Brian, why don't you give us your thoughts first?
Sure. So yeah, just to echo my sentiments on question one, emergency funds are extremely important. It's a defensive strategy. It's like your car insurance or your homeowner's insurance. They save you from large, unmanageable expenses. Now, if you don't have the means to set up an emergency fund, that's pretty difficult. It's kind of like you can't get blood from a stone type deal, right? You have to find a way to sort of earn more. And it could be more education, getting some sort of degree or MBA, or going into a career path where you know you can make more money. So it's hard if you don't have the money to build up emergency funds, but they are important. But let's say you do have the means, like you have a decent job and you have excess cash flow at the end of each month. You know, the best thing to do is you have to budget, right? You have to set up a budget. And, you know, in my opinion, there are three types of savers in the world. The first one is somebody who gets a paycheck. They impulsively buy whatever they want. And then if there's anything left over at the end of the month, they save it, right? Those are people that are very financially dependent on things like credit cards, personal loans, You know, they end a family, they end up in a lot of debt. Those aren't great savers, you know, so that's the first kind. The second type is somebody who does the opposite. They get their paycheck, they save first, and then they spend second. So they have some sort of plan where they put some money aside, and then, you know, every month they do this, and then whatever's left over, then they spend it. And the third person is somebody who are the people that we typically work with. They earn a paycheck just like person one and two, but what they do is they save first, then they find ways to invest, whether it's through all these great apps out there like Acorns and Robinhood. So they save, they invest, and then they spend what's left over. Those people are financially independent. They save emergency fund, they invest, they have money working towards a different goal, whether it's education, future education, buying a house, or just general investing or retirement. Those are the most financially independent. And that's where most of the wealth is built when you start investing. So yeah, emergency funds are very important. And I think, Eric, you'll elaborate a little bit more on the second part of that question.
Yeah, now what you said is that those three different categories of how we are behaviorally, it's important for you guys to really look in the mirror and diagnose where you are. Because here's the good news, wherever you happen to land, you have control. We can all move. It doesn't matter how much little money we make or how abundant or scarce our means are. We can all behaviorally decide to be the person that saves first and pays our future self first and deals with everything else second. And so it's important to understand where you fall there so that you can make the appropriate changes to build emergency funds. Now, I want to add some additional context to what Brian said. There's three different functions that emergency savings will serve in your financial life. We're all familiar with the first, and it's your ability to absorb financial shock. Like Brian said, it's an injury and you have a medical deductible. It's losing a job temporarily and needing to pay your bills. It's you know, having a family emergency and you have to travel and buy a plane ticket. It's whatever, right? Your ability to absorb financial shock. And that is really important to our own emotional and mental security about our money and also situationally. But there's two other things that I want to highlight that savings to other functions, savings plays that isn't as commonly thought of. The first one is savings represents a wealth building opportunity that has not yet presented itself. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm going to tell you a story of my own personal life to illustrate that. So I was working at a bank. That was my first job in financial services. And at this particular point in time, the housing markets were really buyer friendly. We're not talking too long after the crash of 2008. Prices were in the tank. And I knew that it was an opportune time to buy a house. And I was pretty young. I was like 19, 20 years old. And I wanted to buy a house. I had enough income to get approved for a loan, but I didn't have the money for a down payment to get into a home. There's a colleague of mine or an associate. I ended up working with him in my business years later. So I didn't know him at the time. But he was in a similar situation and he made the same income as I did at that point in time. And he saw the same opportunity. He's like, man, houses are selling for really cheap. Very different than the market right now. I don't know if any of you guys have looked at the real estate markets or any of your parents have, or you know anybody who's recently bought a house, but they're really bad for buyers right now. But at this time, they were really good. So he looked at the market and the difference between him and I is that he had been a better saver, right? He didn't necessarily know what he was saving for, but he was a better saver. I spent my excess money. He saved his excess money. So he had 30 grand in savings at that point in time. And he didn't really necessarily have a purpose for it, but he had just saved it for a rainy day or an opportunity, whatever. And he was able to buy his first home. Fast forward, the market turned and the housing market became more seller friendly. And within 5 years, he was able to sell that house for twice as much as he bought it for. Fast forward even further to now, we're talking 10, 11 years later. He's worth millions of dollars. He owns 6 different LLCs and probably 20 or 30 different investment properties. And the difference between him and I at that time is simply that he had the flexibility to take advantage of the opportunity window because he had cash. And I had no cash because he was a better saver. We made the same amount of money. We were both pretty educated. We were both in the finance world, but he had the ability to make a move. And that first home sale where he was able to take advantage of that opportunity window was really the bandwidth that allowed him to take that and do it again and again and again and make it bigger and bigger and bigger. So when we think about emergency savings or savings in general, it's also your control, it's your flexibility, it's your dexterity to do the types of things that can take the rest of your financial life and really change the trajectory. Real estate markets is one place where that happens. Regular investment markets are another place where that happens. Sometimes the economy is doing really well, sometimes it's really low. And when the stock market is down and it's doing really poorly, well, everything, all the investments in the stock market are basically on sale at a discount. So you put money in there and you're buying more investments for the same amount of money that you can then enjoy the growth and appreciation of when the market swings back your way. So that's the second function of savings. And I think that it's really important that we don't gloss over that. The third is behavioral. Brian, I think you had something to add there.
Oh, no. It's kind of the millionaire next door type story where, you know, you have somebody who makes a lot of money, but has nothing to show for it. Very flashy. And then you have somebody who makes very little money, but they're just better savers. And you read the book, The Millionaire Next Door, and there's a lot of stories like that in that book. And that's kind of when you're describing the story, that's what I think of is that book, you know, which, by the way, if you guys want a good read, definitely recommend that book.
It's a great book.
By Thomas Stanley, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, it's about building the habit. It's about just making it a part of who you are and your identity. Because then you're in a position of power. Brian, you can probably attest, we have clients all over the spectrum. We've been in the business a long time. And some of our most affluent clients, you would never know it just by the car that they drive up to the bank in, or if you went over to their house and you've got people that are driving Audis and $60,000 trucks that really have no money, right? And they've just financed it all. So it's not always necessarily what you think. And that really goes to the third function of savings. And that's really the behavioral element to it. When you think about the efficiency of building wealth, it's important that we take advantage of investment markets and that we save in places where our money can ultimately grow over time. Well, if you don't have a properly funded emergency savings bucket, it's hard to go invest money and take risk on it, which you need to do in order to really grow the money, knowing that if something happens that you're not expecting, you're going to need to get at that money. If you need to worry about what that money is going to be worth on Tuesday, you can't really take any real risk with the money. So having emergency savings gives you the ability to absorb financial shock, but it also allows you to separate the purposes of different buckets of money in your own mind so that the money that you do put towards your retirement or your long-term house purchase goal or whatever longer-term goal that you're investing for, you have the permission to really take the risk that you need to take to be able to experience the type of growth that investments can offer. Unless you have a properly funded emergency savings bucket, then that money is kind of playing dual purpose. You might need it, you might not need it. You don't have the clarity to really be able to make efficient choices when it comes to growing your wealth. So those are the three ways that emergency savings is going to help you over the course of time. And the way to build it, I don't know exactly which one of those ways is going to help each of you guys, but the first step is to make the choice to move yourself, if you're not already there, into that bucket that saves first and spends after, and adjust the rest of your budget around paying yourself first. Because when you save, you're paying yourself. You're just paying your future self. And it might not feel as valuable today, but one day you're going to be that person. And if you didn't, you're going to wish that you had paid that person.
Wait, before we move on to the next question, this reminds me, have you guys read the book Atomic Habits?
I have.
Yeah, yep. Talking about habit stacking and 1% change and all of that. So a lot of the behavioral cues you're talking about remind me a lot of the education from that book, Atomic Habits. So another book, if you guys are looking for recommendations.
We could probably sit here and give you 1,000 recommendations.
Because you're college students, you don't read enough as it is, right?
Well, you know what? They probably are too busy reading the required reading. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. That book changed my life. That I don't know if you guys have read that.
What was that again? Brian, say it again.
Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. It's written back in the 1950s. But that book has really changed the way I think of thought about money, you know. So, I was a typical college kid, just like everybody on this call. And back, I graduated in 2004. Credit was very loose back then. It was pre-2008. It's when you could, if you could fog a mirror, you could get a house. Stated in interest rate loans. You didn't even have to prove income and you could buy a house. So I fell into a lot, made a lot of mistakes early, and that book changed my life. So yeah, there's three book recommendations for everybody on the call.
Awesome. Okay, so we'll move on to our third and final question. And this one comes from Tuan Duong. Tuan's question is, how much money, if any, should I put into any stocks? What is your investment philosophy? What should young people around this age be doing to stretch and make the most out of their money? And personally, how do you address impulse buying? So Eric, why don't you kick us off on this one?
Eric, let me jump in real quick. So
sure.
We just answered those two questions previous, all about emergency funds, right? A lot. First one, we talked about emergency funds. Second one, we talked about emergency fund. When people come into our office wanting to invest, saying, okay, here, you know, I have money, you know, what's your investment philosophy? How much should I put in stocks? The emergency fund is the foundation. If you come in with $5,000 or $10,000 and you say, I want to invest, and that's all you have, we're going to say you're not ready yet. You know, so the reason Eric and I keep harping on the emergency fund is that's building the foundation. You know, if you ever, you know, build a house down the road, you don't call the general contractor and say, send me the roof, right? That just doesn't make sense. The investing is the sexy part of things, but we have to have the foundation in place before we go there. So that's why, you know, we pick those, you're talking to financial planners that help people invest. That's why we're really harping on emergency funds. So Eric, go ahead.
Sure. No, I appreciate that, Brian. It may sound counterintuitive, but to make the most out of your money, even at this stage where you're in college, you don't necessarily have the career job, I'm sure money's probably tight. Young people need to prioritize their future selves first. In psychology, and a lot of this job in terms of behavioral finance and financial planning is really more psychology than it is finance, right? There's this phenomenon called hyperbolic discounting. And hyperbolic discounting refers to people's tendencies to increasingly choose a smaller, sooner reward over a larger later reward, because they perceive more value in the smallest amount, in the smaller reward sooner than the larger reward later. Well, when you think about the time value of money, I'm going to draw you a picture here. If you can envision it in your mind, imagine you invest $100 that grows 10% every year. If you invest $100 today and it grows at 10%, next year you have $110. If it grows 10% the next year, you probably have like $121. If this repeats year over year over year, you're only making a little over 10 bucks a year in earnings at the beginning, and it's slowly starting to creep up as your base balance starts to get larger and larger. However, as it continues to compound on itself, the same 10% of earnings equals larger and larger sums of money as time goes on. Eventually, the curve of compound interest, if you can imagine the picture that I'm drawing in your mind, starts shooting up at a much steeper pace. In year 30 of the example that I just gave, that 10% compounding would yield you earnings of $159 in year 30 versus 10 in year one. And that's on the original $100 that you invested. The earnings in themselves are 16 times more than the earnings you had in year one. And your earnings in year 30 are 159% of your entire original investment. So your total investment balance on that $100 contribution in year 30 would be $1,745. This is a compounded at 10% every year. Compare this, for example, to investing $300, which is three times as much as the 100, but only leaving it invested for half the time. So we'll invest three times the amount of money, but instead of investing it for 30 years, we'll invest it for 15 years. At the end of year 15, you would have $1,253, which is only 71% of what you ended up with in the first scenario. So in scenario one, you invest $100 at 10% for 30 years, you have $1,745. Scenario two, you invest $300 at 10% for 15 years, you have $1,253. So what's the point here? The point is, the younger you are, the more time you leave the money invested, the more time you let it bake, as we like to say, the more powerful your investment truly is. Because you are so far off from retirement or having to use those long-term investments, the power of your money now is so much greater than what it's going to be in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years when you have a stable job and you feel like you've made it. So the money's growth potential, you want to invest it when that dollar is going to have the most potent earning potential, and the earlier, the better. So if you have the thinking of I'll do it in my 30s, or I'll do it after I get out of school, or I'll do it after I pay off my school debt, I'll do it after I buy my first house, I'll do it after I take some trips and find myself and have some fun, you're going to miss the boat. So I encourage you, it doesn't need to be 50% of your overall income. It can be whatever, literally, it can be 10% of your income, whatever you can do to get started. Pay your future self first, because hyperbolic discounting seems nice in the moment, but fast forward 20, 30 years and you're going to wish you did it. Impulse buying, we talked about it a little bit in the previous answer, but I want to round it out a little bit. When you're doing the things that you need to do to exhibit what we call responsible financial governance, impulse buying becomes much less of a concern. Okay, impulse buying is not necessarily bad in and of itself. To see something that you want and buy it is not inherently a bad thing to do. The reason why it's a bad thing to do for most people is because they do it at the expense of paying their future selves. They do it at the expense of saving in their emergency fund. They do it at the expense of paying down their debt. And they don't have a sense of financial governance to even understand how these impulse purchases are going to interact and impact the rest of their financial goals. So they often end up overspending because they don't have a good understanding of what they really have available to spend. When you budget appropriately, you keep track of your cash flow. You pay yourself first, like Brian said, you save first and then you spend later. Well, if you've carved out a piece of your budget that's earmarked for spending, within those guardrails that you set up for yourself, as long as you're doing the things you need to do, impulse buying is not necessarily the worst thing. Along the way, as we continue to make money and move on in our careers and you advance beyond college and reach great heights, I'm sure. You know, we do all this financial planning ultimately so that we can enjoy our lives. It's okay to enjoy it along the way, as long as you're doing the things that you need to do. So the answer to the question on impulse buying is budget and keep track of your cash flow. Because if you do that, you know how much you have available to spend and you don't have to feel guilty about spending it. If you want to spend it on Netflix, if you want to spend it on, you know, I don't know what college kids are spending it on, whatever you want to spend it on, spend away.
Video games.
Within the guardrails that you've set up. What's that, Brian?
Video games.
Video games. There you go. I play a couple. I play MLB The Show. I don't know if any of you are baseball fans. That's about the only video game I play. So hopefully that answers the question on impulse buying.
As far as investment philosophy, so investment philosophy is the key to investing. You talked about investing as a psychological behavior is something that Eric and I deal with on a regular basis, especially in the last 12 to 18 months with COVID. When we saw the market decline back in March of last year, you know, that was a big shock to a lot of people, because before that, the economy was really cranking on all cylinders. The market was doing exceptionally well. And then, you know, COVID kind of hit us, blindsided us, and a lot of players were down, you know, 15-20%. So, you know, investors, when they do it on their own, they have counterintuitive behavior. They sell when they should be buying and buy when they should be selling. So investment philosophy, if you're going to invest in the market, you can't eliminate risk. The only way to eliminate risk is not invest in the market. Put your money in the credit unions, the banks, under your mattress. All you can do is manage risk. And how you do that is through diversification. You know, you own multiple asset classes, you build in some cash, you own international as well as domestic. So you really have to spread the risk out. And then you have to skew your investments based on your investment risk tolerance and your time horizon. If you're young and just starting out, you can afford, and you have your foundation, you can afford to take more risk and own more equities. If you're older, I have a lot of clients that are in their 60s and approaching retirement, they're looking at risk and they're looking at money a lot differently. So as far as investment philosophy, it's really diversification, spreading the risk. The problem with a lot of the apps out there today, the do-it-yourself type apps, is people are buying stocks, not really knowing what they own. not really knowing the taxation of the investments that they're buying. And they're seeing a lot of volatility in their portfolio because they're not well diversified. And then they're reacting to that volatility in a negative way. So understanding what your goals are, risk tolerance, time horizon, and then building a portfolio based on what those goals are. So that's really what our investment philosophy is. So yeah, great question. All great questions. Like Becky said, we got a lot of very good questions.
I was really impressed by the questions that came in.
So yeah, so thank you guys for all the great questions and congratulations to all the winners.
Yeah, so that's all the time that we have, I think, for today. Brian and Eric, thank you so much for your expert insight as always. You guys are always incredible and really take the planning part of my finance and bring it down to a level where I can understand it. So I appreciate you for that. Thank you so much to the UNH Trio students for joining us live and for submitting such thoughtful questions. Like I said, they were just amazing and we were blown away. Be sure to check out our Making Money Personal podcast wherever you listen to podcasts for more financial education tips. Like I said earlier, Eric and Brian are guest speakers on a number of them. Thank you and have a great day.